Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Matthias is setting up a picture because I know the reading is going to make you curious about something. Something that I'm going to talk about in the reading that most of us have no idea what it looks like. So nice to have a graphic. Martin Luther King Birthday Sunday, always a challenge and always a big responsibility. Martin Luther King, who was America's minister, even to the people who hated him, he was still their minister. That's a heck of a minister. So I'm going to try and do my best today. Not so much his words, but words that he drew from, sources that he drew from. I want to thank Emmy, too, for sending a video that really helped me to tie this thing together today. So that source I'm talking about is the book of Amos in the Hebrew Bible. No one knew who Amos was when he began heaping shame on his homeland at one of its main temples, located on a street by that great city wall. He occupied that great walled street with no more than his body and his voice, addressing all of the people, but especially the rulers and leading citizens, prophesying, as it was called in the land at that time. The high priest was incensed and sent a warning to the king about what this man was doing, saying, "The land is not able to bear all his words." And then he told Amos to get away from the temple. "Oh, seer, go, flee away home and eat bread there and prophesy there, but never again prophesy here, for this is the king's sanctuary and it's the temple of the kingdom." So religion on this street is a religion of power, of the king, by the state, for the mighty. The priest is used to being obeyed instantly and expects the scruffy man to get lost now. But Amos replies, "Let's get something straight. I am no prophet, nor a prophet's son, but I'm a shepherd and a scratcher of sycamore figs. And the Lord took me from following the flock, and the Lord said to me, 'Go prophesy to my people.'" The role of prophet, you have to understand, had become institutionalized. It was even a hereditary occupation with guaranteed income. Go eat bread. Bread, even then, meant money, then as now. And a comfortable place. It also meant a comfortable place in society's upper ranks. But Amos comes from the bottom. Wandering with the sheep was work for children, the disabled, or for very old men who could no longer do anything else. Sycamore figs produced a thin-fleshed, poor-quality fruit that can be improved somewhat by scratching it or cutting it lightly as it develops and poking it. The irritation causes the fruit to thicken a little, and the puncture releases the bugs inside before they eat too much of the fruit. And you have to do each one by hand. Each one. This was food for times of famine, or for those who lived in chronic poverty, who had to wander and scratch to get by fruit, by sorry little fruit that no one else would eat. Someone like that should be ashamed to even come near a place like the state-run temple. But listen to him now, telling his betters to be ashamed. Who does this old geezer think he is? He's not important. He isn't famous. So why should Amos shame us? Why is he occupying this space on our great walled street, so long reserved for those in power? I'll say some more about that after Ellen occupies our ears with her music. We're ready to be occupied. Excuse me. How did I do that? Until our choir occupies our ears. Remember, we will stumble. That's part of our covenant. It's really a promise.
Just waiting for the band to get assembled.
Just the opening. Make sure everybody can see. Do we have one more time?
I dream,
so much. Thank you so much. You know, did anybody ever try to play the violin? It starts with just this scratch, and you know, and your voice. It's kind of like a scratchy thing. You put your heart in it, and this is what you get. Put the heart into the scratch, and this is what you get. Thank you so much. Well, to continue our story.
Sure. I forgot to announce it earlier. This piece is called I Dream, and it's written by B.W. Mertz, who's a gospel choir director in California. Oh,
thank you. Thank you. Well, back to our story. The big shots on that walled street, were probably delighted by Amos at first. He'd started by heaping shame on his homeland's enemies and rivals, which was a common practice at the temple's religious services. Thus says the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Damascus and for 4, I will not hold back the punishment, because they've threshed Gilead with threshing sleds of iron. For 3 transgressions of Edom and for 4, I will not hold back punishment, because he pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity. For 3 transgressions of Moab and for 4, I will not hold back punishment, because he burned to lime the bones of the king of Edom. Little explanation here. Syria, the Philistines, Moab, the Edomites. To Amos's audience, this was a familiar axis of evil. Bring it on. Heap on the shame. No words could be too extreme when it came to these stinkers. But listen carefully. Amos is not shaming them from what they might have done or tried to do to Israel. It's for what they've done to each other. The Edomite king attacked his Moabite brothers, but after defeating him, the Moabites desecrated his corpse, burning his bones without a proper burial. Terrible thing in those days. The Syrians threshed Gilead, the nation of Gilead, with threshing sleds of iron, which will take some explanation. Threshing sleds were among the most important technological innovations of the ancient world, and people knew it. What may be the oldest written record in all of human history is a 6,000-year-old cuneiform tablet, which includes a picture of a threshing sled. Such sleds were used to separate edible kernels of grain from the tough fiber husk. They were made of wood with stone pebbles or flints embedded in the bottom. They were pulled by animals over grain spread on a threshing floor. The sleds permitted grain to be threshed quickly and in larger quantities than had ever been possible before their invention, and contributed to the first great concentrations of wealth and power. Some were painted, decorated with gold and jewels, fitted with chairs or thrones. Tomb paintings indicate that these were written by rulers in annual harvest ceremonies. Threshing floors, which are also expensive to build or maintain, were often placed on hilltops where winds could help the separation process. The sites of these floors were often considered sacred, and even the great temple of Jerusalem was designed and built around a threshing floor. Sycamore figs, threshing sleds. Sorry, you probably weren't expecting a lecture on ancient agricultural practices this morning. But now we can understand Amos when he speaks of threshing a community with threshing sleds of iron, though they're ordinarily made of wood. These instruments of abundance, which could be used to make plenty available to all, have been used instead to impoverish. They have been weaponized and used to crush the very life out of people in almost ceremonial acts of destruction. Maybe you can think of some modern technological instruments that have been used like this, or maybe some financial instruments. Amos has got his audience thinking about how economic, military, political, and even religious events can come together, and so far it's all comfortably over there. It's those guys who live in the axis of evil. But now that he's occupied their attention, he lets these words fly. For 3 transgressions of Judah, and for 4, I will not hold back the punishment, because they've rejected the law of the Lord and have not kept his statutes, but their lies have led them astray. So I will send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the strongholds of Jerusalem, thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four. Of Israel and for four. I will not hold back the punishment, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, that they trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and turn away the afflicted. So Amos has saved the strongest words, his strongest words, for his homeland, which instead of sharing in the disasters of those other nations, has been enjoying a period of unprecedented prosperity, at least for its wealthiest citizens. The markets are off the charts. While the many go hungry or homeless, the few on top take pride comparing their vacation homes, which are mentioned in the Bible. But Amos warns, I will smash your winter house upon your summer house, and the houses of ivory shall perish, and the great houses shall have an end. We're supposed to be the people with the highest standards, responding to the highest call of any nation, he says. It's something that goes even beyond a call. Thus says the Lord, you only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all of your iniquities. Now those of you who did grow up with some kind of a church or synagogue experience might remember giggling in school, Sunday school or Saturday school, when somebody explained what the Bible meant when it said that Adam and Eve knew each other. Right? Remember that? Those who learned about that. And you remember what fun that was to know. But here Amos recalls a special intimacy. That's what he means. A special intimacy between a people and their God. Something hot and very, very heavy that now has been betrayed. You don't betray people you've been intimate with, right? Betrayed by how people treat each other, by how the strong treat the weak, how the wealthy treat the poor. It doesn't matter that they keep up the outward appearances of religious faith. God says, I hate, I despise your feasts. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Though you offer me your burnt offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fatted beasts, I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. To the melody of your harps, I will not listen. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. That's not a plan or a demand or a proposal. It's prophecy. Let justice roll down like waters. Glory, glory when at last it comes to pass, but shame on you, on us until it does. That's what Amos meant, like Martin Luther King did when he borrowed the prophet's words. I'm always surprised when public figures are confronted with a shameful act from their past, then deny or say they can't remember it. I forget some things, but I remember every shameful act that I've committed, or at least I think I do, as much as I might want to forget. I don't remember if I was 3 or 4, but I remember stealing a toy gun from a friend, smuggling it home under my shirt, and then almost immediately confessing to my parents. I don't remember if I was 15 or 16, but I remember leaving a book open on a table before a friend of mine came into the room, open to a gross picture that I knew would upset him. It was Goya's War, or Goya's Saturn. I don't remember the date, but I will never forget the act, and I'm still so sorry. Antonio, I'm still ashamed. I'm still ashamed. I'm not ashamed of my income, considering that it's for half-time work. Double for full-time would seem just about right, really. I don't freak out with envy when I hear that another professional earns twice or even 10 times what I do. Maybe a medical specialist or an inventor or someone like that. I don't know what you'd do with that much. Maybe some good works on behalf of others. Maybe you got more kids you're trying to put through college, or like billionaire Bruce Wayne, you spend your evenings dressed as Batman, fighting crime, chasing down bad guys like the Joker. But what about someone who earns 100 times more? What about 1,000 times? Or even more than that. There are people who earn more than my yearly salary for a one-hour consultation. Isn't that a shame? One very wealthy public figure recently said, yes, if you're not rich, can't figure out the angles and make the right moves, then shame on you. Or maybe you're not smart enough to avoid paying your taxes. Shame on me? Really? Shouldn't it be shame on him for suggesting that poverty is the fault of the poor? Or isn't it shame on us for allowing such disparities to continue and to grow larger and larger? I do know, that many religious liberals are uncomfortable with the notion of shame or using shame to motivate changes in our behavior. I get it. We remember that Sunday school lesson again, the one about Adam and Eve, and how it helped turn us off to church and religion for a long, long time. The man and the woman had been bopping around the garden, enjoying the flowers and the trees and the breeze blowing over their sweet bare skin. But one sweet bite of fruit later, and suddenly they're aware of a nakedness that had seemed perfectly normal just a moment before. Now they feel ashamed. Hold on, we thought. That's not right. The human body is something tender, beautiful, nothing to feel ashamed of. Many religious leaders of many different faith traditions, including our own, agree and have added their names to the ecumenical religious declaration on sexuality, morality, justice, and healing. If you Google religious declaration, that's the first one that will come up, which begins, sexuality is God's life-giving and life-fulfilling gift. And it continues, we sin when this sacred gift is abused or exploited. However, the great promise of our religious tradition is love, healing, and restored relationships. Yes, indeed. But even as we affirm the sacredness of the full range of human sexuality, sexual abuse and exploitation remain sins in our various traditions, including our own, I think. It's shameful when religious institutions protect abusers behind their walls. And it's interesting that Amos never once uses the Hebrew word for shame, even as he lays it on, hot and very, very heavy. Maybe a sense of shame requires some self-awareness, like Eve and Adam shared, but he senses so far little, if any, in the people he's addressing. Standing by the gate of that great walled temple, occupying space on that great walled street, making people look at him eye to eye, he's trying his best to raise that shame, to birth it into being. If he can't do it, or the people are no longer capable of feeling it, what a shame that would be. I'm sure that's something really hard to do when no one knows who you are, right? Then as now, fame counts for everything, right? Who was Amos anyway? A real man or just a character in a book? It's entirely possible that there was no historical Amos, no single individual. It's very likely. His name might be derived from the verb amas, which means something like to lay a heavy yoke upon something or someone. Maybe it refers to the heavy work of waking people from their complacency. Maybe the name was a way to personify a social movement that laid the yoke of shame on those few who controlled so much of the nation's wealth. Maybe Amos was an idealized rallying figure, something like Uncle Sam or Rosie the Riveter. This would fit well with some of the other names that we find in the book called Amos, when it warns of the catastrophe that's bound to come if things don't change pretty quickly. Here it is. Caesar of the bow. This is someone's name. Caesar of the bow will not make a stand. Swift of foot will not escape. Horse rider will not save his own life. Sort of a Clint Eastwood figure, I guess. And even brave heart among the mighty will slip away naked. Mel Gibson, for sure. And even God says of himself in this passage, I am bogger down beneath. It's God's name for himself, for God, bogger down. The old boggeroo. I'm the bogger down beneath of all these mighty ones who will soon lose their powers and be stuck like a wagon in the mud. There's a comic book or action figure quality to these names, just like for Amos, if that name really does mean something like layer on of the heavy yoke, or maybe the yoker. I don't think, though, that Batman would have any problem with this yoker, and I'm sure that he'd see him as a fellow member of the Justice League. Right, Superman, Batman, that's the Justice League. All those characters, We all know who they are, but who was Amos? The temple priest calls him a prophet, but he rejects the title. He rejects that title along with the notion of making bread or profiting from this compromised professional position. So who was this non-profit prophet? No one knows. But I like to think of him as just who he says he is. A shepherd and a scratcher of sycamore figs. Many of us feel the need for a shepherd when we look around and see so many sheep bleeding for some kind of guidance, wandering aimlessly from one diversion to another. The word shepherd has always had a gentle and appealing sound. But I also think that we need a scratcher of sycamore figs, more than one, not just MLK or Reverend William Barber. Remember what that scratching involved, irritating the fruit to make it bigger and sweeter and poking a hole to release the bugs inside before they eat the whole thing. We need someone to do that for us, whether it's an individual or a movement, someone who will provoke us in ways that make us grow. Who's it going to be? Think one will be enough? What you doing tomorrow? What you doing later today? Even if it scratches a little, even if we're scratched a little, it won't kill us. We'll make us stronger people. Strong like swift of foot or brave heart among the mighty? I'm not sure, but I hope that it will make us sweeter. I think it will, if we can take our scratching and poking. Who knows, if we keep on scratching fig by fig, tree by tree, orchard by orchard, one day the fruit will be full and juicy enough to burst with loving kindness. May we then feel justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. If such can be the fruit of shame, then that's some fruit indeed. Glory. Glory. And so may it be.